WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service. Mostly sunny skies today, a high around 80, partly cloudy tonight, a low of 65. For the weekend, sunny and hot tomorrow, Saturday, a high of 91. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy, a low of 70. For Sunday, mostly sunny, a little cooler if anything, but not by much. Sunday's high, 89. Next chance of some precipitation coming up late Sunday night and into Monday. Right now, a mix of sun and clouds, a temperature reading of 66. The morning show is next. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. JackandDrea.com, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. Support for the morning show also comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in four easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have two interviews for you today. We'll be talking politics a little later in the afternoon, but first we're talking art and specifically previewing this Sunday's Starving Artist Fair in Racine, the 51st annual Starving Artist Fair sponsored by the Racine Art Guild. And we have two persons with us who have been incredibly busy helping to put together this year's event, they and their colleagues from the Racine Art Guild. Sue Smith is the chairman of this year's Starving Artist Fair and a relatively new addition to the Racine Art Guild. And also with us is someone who is a not-so-new addition to the Racine Art Guild, and in fact, a charter member of the Racine Art Guild, Joe Nissen, who has been with us before and who can certainly give us a wonderful sort of long-term historical view of this really wonderful event, which happens always on the first Sunday in August on the Racine campus of Gateway Technical College. And rain or shine, but there'll be plenty of shine this year. It's going to be a sunny Sunday for the Starving Artist Fair. Sue Smith, Joe Nissen, we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Thank you. Greg.
Good to have you here. I want to say right off the bat, I don't want to have time run out before I have time to say this, and this is absolutely true. My wife's Aunt Linda, who lives in St. Louis, comes up for a visit or two every single year, and she always plans her summer visit around the Racine Starving Artist Fair. She wants to be here for it because, I mean, just quite by accident, she came to one, you know, probably 15, maybe even 20 years ago, and loved it so much that she actually plans her trip to Racine to be here for this event. So I thought you two ladies would appreciate knowing that.
Yes.
Yes, it's very
delighted
nice
to have her. Does she have any friends she can bring along?
Yes, bring a bus. Yes.
Well, yeah, right. Well, as a matter of fact, it doesn't seem like it's usually a problem to get people to come to the Starving Artist Fair. It feels like each and every year it becomes more and more sort of crowded with patrons and crowded with artists. And Sue, you were saying that this year is going to be especially crowded in terms of number of artists who are there.
Yeah, we're full this year. So, every year it's a little bit of a struggle to, try to make sure that you've got enough artists. And this year we've got about 60%, 70% of our artists are returning artists, and about 30% are brand new artists. So that's always something interesting. And that was something that I really wanted to push for, was to not just have returning artists so that we see the same material, but I wanted to bring something new to the table. So I worked really hard at advertising kind of far and wide beyond just Racine into, the general Midwest area. And we've got some folks coming from, a couple hundred miles away. So I'm really excited about some of the new folks coming to the fair, too.
Absolutely. And you were saying that you have actually, for some period now, I don't remember how long, have actually now been turning artists away who have been calling up or emailing interested.
Right. We've been full since the end of May. So all through June and July, I've been sort of, putting people on a wait list. And then, the last week or so, I've had to respond to them and say, I'm sorry that we're full. So, yeah, come on down, because every tent will be full, and we've got all kinds of wonderful things planned. We're going to have some musicians there. We've got a new food court area where we've got some food trucks coming in. And so we've got tables and chairs. We'll be able to sit down and relax and listen to some wonderful live music and share some wonderful new food and, walk through the art stalls and see some new artists and some returning artists. So it's really going to be a good time. So I'm looking forward to it. I really am.
I think it'd be interesting for people to hear a little bit about how you have come to this position as chair of this year's Starving Artists Fair. As I said, you're a relative newcomer to the Racine Art Guild, but really not a newcomer to the Starving Artists Fair itself. Tell our listeners a little bit about your own background, if you would.
Yeah, because, I too, like your wife's aunt, have been a big fan of the Starving Art Fair, and it was something that I made sure that I went to every year. And I have just recently, in the little over a year ago, I retired, and I was looking to kind of fulfill the artist in me rather than the business person in me. And I went to the Racine Art Guild because I found out that they were the ones who were hosting the fair. So it was really kind of the fair that took me to the Racine Art Guild, and I found out what a wonderful group of people they are, and I've had a lot of fun at the meetings. And then, last year when they came to a point where they were looking for someone to chair this, and I said, that's something that I could do for them, because I have, a business background. I knew how to do project management, and it probably something that, they probably have a little gap in. So I stepped forward and I said, I'm going to do it this year, and I've learned a lot about art. I've learned a lot about art fairs. I've learned a lot about marketing and social media and all kinds of wonderful new things that I've learned. And I've been able to have a lot of fun with the artists and kind of see some new things and look at some artwork that I probably never would have had a chance to. So it's been a wonderful experience for me. And so I'm just having a ball with it.
That's terrific. It seems like an absolutely perfect match. Joe Nissen, you said something interesting before we went on the air about the typical artist being, in a sense, kind of a solitary figure.
An artist works alone, usually. He or she works alone. And so a project like this is different for them. It is very expansive, and they are not always real cooperative. this becomes a challenge. But the one thing that they all love to do is to show their artwork. So this is an opportunity that they might not have because they work as a solitary loner type of individual. So, but they are always looking for shows, an opportunity to show their work. So this, and because our art fair is juried, and so we do demand a certain level of quality from them. So it doesn't have the very basic, I always say, the tissue paper person who does toilet paper sculpture.
Yeah, right.
We want more.
Yeah, we want this truly to be artwork. And I suppose the other thing, too, is not only is this a juried event, but it's also very well put together. And, of course, that's important for an artist as well, even if maybe they themselves don't possess those organizational gifts. Nevertheless, they want to be able to display their artwork in an art fair that is well organized and well publicized. I mean, an organization that is an event that's put together well.
Absolutely, yeah. These artists, and especially now, you know, in the age of the internet, they have access to, you know, websites that show them art fair after art fair after art fair, and so they have choices. You know, it's not just the art fair that comes to their backyard. They have choices, and so they can be, choosy. They can be fussy over which art fair they're going to be participating in. You're absolutely right. So there's a responsibility on the group that's holding the art fair to make sure that, you know, that there is an audience for these artists, you know, so that there is, someone who comes and looks at their artwork, who will buy their artwork, that there is, you know, an organization behind it, that it's not just, you know, somebody's, you know, threw a shingle out and they're not, you know, doing what they're supposed to be doing. So they do look for organization, and they do look for a quality art show that's being put on. So there is competition for us, you know, for the artists. So there's two sides to this coin as well. So, you know, you've got two audiences, the artists and the customers that come to the fair.
And you want to keep all of them happy, both of those constituencies.
Yes.
And artists regularly look at other artists' work as well. And they will let us know if they feel that people who are in there are not up to the standard.
Interesting.
So, yeah, we will hear from them. We'll hear from them. So they do appreciate our fair.
Yeah. For those of you just joining us, we're talking about the Starving Artist Fair in Racine, which occurs this Sunday afternoon, August 5th. Rain or shine, 9 to 4, but it's going to be a very, very sunny day. Yeah. And nice and warm, so the best place to be is on the lakefront, of course. And this will be an event in which more than 100 different artists will be displaying their wares. Sue Smith, explain why it's called the Starving Artists Fair. I mean, that's really an important thing to know.
Well, it's part of our legacy branding, for one thing. But typically, a Starving Artist Fair is a fair that has a cap on the prices on the artwork that's for sale. So people who are coming to the fair know that, you know, they can expect something that fits in their budget. You know, you're not going to be spending thousands of dollars on a Rembrandt to hang on the wall. You know, it's something that, you know, is approachable and reachable to the common person, that it's affordable and you know, is something that they can go home with. So it's a little bit of a different take on just your standard art fair, where, you know, maybe this one you can actually come and, take some things home with you rather than just come and look at it and then go home with an empty car.
Right, exactly. So what is the cap?
$300.
Okay.
So everything's under $300.
And, of course, lots of things are significantly less than $300.
Yep.
Yeah, that is a nice thing. And it's nice that it's a high-quality art fair, and yet with accessible prices, at least accessible to most people.
Yeah.
Joe Nissen, I'm so glad that you are here because, as I mentioned in the introduction, you are a charter member of the Racine Art Guild. So you have been part of this right from the start. So I would love for you to tell our listeners about how that very, very first Starving Artist Fair got put together. Well, and for that matter, how the Racine Art Guild itself got put together. Take us back to the beginning.
Well, a group of us were in an art class at Worcester Museum.
And when would this have been?
51 years ago.
Okay.
And the instructor looked at us and he said, you know, there is some fine work here. You really ought to be showing this. And so a few of us put our heads together and said, okay, where would we do this? And we found an empty lot on Douglas Avenue in Racine. We cut down all the weeds and blocked it out. We put up a few signs around the city and said, this Sunday, the first Sunday in August, we're having an art fair. We didn't know if anybody would come out or not. And we just hoped it would be all right. Wouldn't you know? Yeah, we thought we were possibly throwing a party and no one would show up. But the city came out. It was really, really busy. And we sold our artwork. We were absolutely astounded. And that was the initial fair for us. And from that, we realized we had something that we had to continue. And so that's what we did.
Wow. And to the best of your recollection, that first one was the first Sunday in August. So in other words, that's one of the traditions.
We stayed with that. And at that time, it was nothing over $25.
Hmm.
And, of course, many of us were literally giving our work away. Oh, you like this? Really? You like this?
Right. Yeah, just the notion that someone would want to pay anything for something. So it was a very much an amateur operation in the best sense of the word.
Literally. Yeah. Yes, it was. And it was fun. And people were very positive. And, of course, you know, you like me? You actually like what I'm doing? Absolutely. Well, we have to do more of this. And so that's the initial part. It started, and we've just kept it blossomed.
Fantastic. Mm-hmm. Any sense, at least roughly speaking, of when the art fair moved to its current location on the Racine campus of Gateway?
It was shortly after that. It was like the second year after that.
Oh.
We were looking around, where could we do this? Where could we try to hold this? And so we talked to the Gateway campus, and they allowed for that. They said, you know, all right, this sounds like a win-win situation. And it obviously was. And it just expanded from that. Mm-hmm. So, and at that time, we also had the Armenians who were doing their food. And so they had their food with us as well. Well, they elected to go on, and they are still operating, but they're down at the lakefront. So we have a variety of other foods now. Hmm. This has worked really, really well.
Yeah.
Frankly, it is a great joy.
Yeah. Well, and for you to see it evolve over the course of half a century from very modest beginnings to something that's just spectacular. That has to feel so good for you to see this.
Absolutely. It's astounding. Mm-hmm. And the city loves it. Mm-hmm. Racine is essentially a city that loves the arts. So whether it is the performing arts, the visual arts, but this community does come out.
Absolutely. Sue Smith, tell us a little bit about what Joel mentioned briefly in passing about how this is a juried event.
Yeah.
Can you just tell us a little more about what that process exactly is, the jurying process?
Okay, sure. Because so I mentioned before that we have a certain number of our returning artists. They do not participate in that. So if you've been in the fair the year before, that you're waived from that. So new artists that present themselves and are interested in coming to our fair, they submit a set of pictures of their artwork that we feel is representative of the things that they're going to bring that fit under the $300, and there is a set of folks, a jury panel in our guild, excuse me, and we take a look at those pictures, and we take a look at what type of material they're bringing, what, you know, is it artwork or is it a craft, I think, is kind of, you know, where we're drawing the line. And what we're looking for is fine art, the true definition of fine art. And as long as it passes the sniff test for fine art, then they're in, you know. So it's not based on whether or not we like the artwork or really, you know, is in our wheelhouse. But as long as it meets that criteria, and we're just looking for to have it elevated a little bit above the craft level.
Sure.
One thing I would like to point out with this this is important to me, is this goes to fund scholarships for us. This is a fundraiser for us. So it's not like we're all going home and you know floating away on our yacht after this is over with. You know, this is very important, and we are funding other students. You know, so we give scholarships to students in school, and we help, you know, to offset the cost of tuition and art supplies and things like that. And this year we have actually increased the amount of money that we're giving for scholarships. by one third because of inflation and other costs. And so this is really important for us to raise more money this year. And so this is our jewel in that crown is to raise those funds. Mm. And so that's important for me.
So I assume the primary revenue stream here then is the artists paying a certain fee.
There's a booth fee that helps to offset the cost of running the fair. However, we have a couple of booths in the fair where we make money. One is a silent auction, which is really a cool event. The artists that come in are asked if they want to donate a piece of their original artwork. So it's original artwork, same juried process that, you know, went through, you know, the other booths that are there. So the artwork that's in the silent auction is fine art, according to the definition, and it's been donated to us. And so if you come on down, you can buy some wonderful pieces at really reasonable prices, even better in the silent auction. And that money just purely goes for the scholarships. The other booth that we have there is the art raffle, where we ask some of the members of the guild to create pieces of artwork. This year we're doing recycled windows. And so we'll be selling those for raffle tickets. So that's the other place that we make some money for our scholarships.
Yeah, I love that medium. I just think that's such a wonderful idea. And
we've got some beautiful windows this year. They're really
outstanding
fun.
Windows this year. Very good.
There is a printed program this year, and I don't remember this before, or certainly I've never seen a printed program that was quite as elaborate and detailed as this. Tell our listeners about it.
Yeah, well, last year we actually did have a little bit of a program. They kind of typed up a list of the artists that were going to be there, and we thought that this year that was such a great idea that we'd expand on that and really turn it into a true program. And so, you know, we took a look at some of the other art fairs in the area and kind of modeled a program after that, and I think that we've got a beautiful program. So when you come on down to the fair, there'll be some boxes out, and you can, you know, take a program. Make sure that you take a look at that. It's got a beautiful map on the back so that you know who is where and what's going on. It gives you some information about the fair and the hours and what time the musical acts are happening. And then it also lists all of the artists inside with a brief description of their artwork. And I thought for fun this year, instead of me, you know, sitting down and saying, okay, here's, you know, John Smith and he's doing ceramics, I thought it would be more fun. So I actually asked the artists to come up with a little blurb for their own artwork. So some of these are quite creative. So if you have a chance to sit down and read through the program, it might be kind of entertaining.
Very good. So the art fair happens on Sunday, and I know, Joe, you get there very, very bright and early. How early do you get there, and why are you there so early?
Well, artists need coffee, don't they? And so I'm there between 5:30 and 6 o'clock to put the coffee pot on. And the artists are supposed to arrive at about 7, but frequently they beat me there. and they're busy setting up. They know where they're supposed to go. And what plot they have been assigned. They need coffee. And so I put the coffee on early, and we have a kringle for them. O&H gives us our kringle. And many of these artists are not from Racine. They are from around the area, and they love Racine kringle. And so that's one of the things they will ask. I'm usually at the reception desk, and they will say, thank you for the coffee, and is the kringle here yet?
Yeah, right. There you go. Very good. Yep. And then, of course, we have artists coming and setting up, and, of course, that's primarily their own function. How does the layout of the fair get put together, and is it relatively random, or do you think very much about where specific artists should go?
You have no idea. I've actually measured the park myself 4 times this year. I've actually been out there with the tape measure and
really?
You know, making sure. Yeah. Because I want to make sure that, you know, we offer the artists a certain square footage, you know, so we give them 12 feet by 11 feet, and we don't want to short sheet anybody, you know. So sometimes, you know, Gateway doing a beautiful job with the park, they'll be planting new trees or something like that. And so sometimes things move around in the park. And so I want to make sure that I'm, you know, delivering a good spot to the artists, because, you know, like I said before, they are my audience, and so I want to make sure that they're happy. And so I'm out there, and I measure exactly where every booth is going to go, and make sure that they have all the space that they're paying for. And then this year was something new. We actually asked the artists if they had a preference on where they would like to be. So if they had a preference, most often they asked for the same booth that they had last year because they, you know, were creatures of habit, and so they like to go back to the same spot. So most of those folks had, you know, gotten their same spot. Then what I do is I try to take a look at what type of artwork they do and then just kind of mix it up so I don't have, you know, a jeweler next to a jeweler, that kind of thing. And so yeah, there's a lot of thought that goes into how it's laid out and who's next to who. And, you know, some folks asked for, you know, morning sun, and some folks asked for, you know, a flat ground. And, you know, so there were some quirky requests that came up, but everybody got what they were asking for. Wow. And so morning sun has morning sun, and we're all set to go. So there was a lot of work and a lot of thought that went into where these booths are and who's getting what booth. So the layout was very important. And then it's also, you know, a lot of thought that went into where's the food court going to go and where the musicians going to go so that they have the greatest audience. Our musicians, by the way, are only work for tips. So if you come on down, you know, throw a couple of bucks in the jar and that makes someone happy. But their location is very important to make sure that they have the traffic flow and that they get the exposure there. So, yes, there's a lot of work that goes into, to, you know, once we've got people signed up, where are they going to be and how are we going to fit this thing in? And that was part of, you know, how many booths do I actually have? You know, when is full, you know? And so I had to go out and make sure, you know, that I wasn't overselling the park either. So there was a lot of work and a lot of thought that went into that.
Well, those details really matter. Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, I have to say, one of the things that's fun about going to various art fairs is just kind of the layout. I mean, the kind of journey that you're taking on, whether it's Library Park here in Kenosha or on the campus of Parkside or you know, various places. A lot has to, or the Capitol Square in downtown,
right?
Madison. I love the way this art fair is laid out in terms of this sort of crisscross diagonal,
the sidewalks, yeah.
And it just gives it kind of a dynamic energy just in the way things are laid out. It's not just a simple square, and it's not also being kind of a meandering path that takes you,
right,
you know, forever. And if you want to get back to something, it's not hard to find it. And especially with your printed program, it's even easier now than it used to be.
Right. And in the center of the park, don't miss the statue. I actually had done a little research about that. It's actually one of only two in the world that have both Mary Todd and Abraham Lincoln in the same statue. And it's very rare that you see a president and his wife in a statue together like that. So when you get to the center of the park, take a minute to take a look at that statue,
because it's
historical.
Visit
yes, it is.
Good idea. We're almost out of time. I want you, Sue, to briefly say a word again about how the fact that there is some new food at this event.
Yes. Yeah, because we've kind of struggled to, you know, to have a good food area. And now this year we're actually having a food court. And so we've got two food trucks that are coming down. We have Meat on the Street coming and Gouda Girls are coming. And they are both listed as top 10 Milwaukee food trucks. And so we're very excited about that. We'll also have the Top Dog Hot Dogs, and the Kettle Corn guy will be out there yelling, you know, so he's a staple for us too. So, but the food court is going to be interesting. It's going to be really good food. So we're going to have some gourmet cheese, grilled cheese kind of food, and some Vietnamese food. So it's going to be very good food. Come on down, visit their website so you get familiar with the menu. I've been looking at this and it makes me hungry every time I look at it. So I'm going to be starving because I'm going to be down there at 6 o'clock with Joe, and I can hardly wait until they get the food trucks fired up because I'm going to be one of the first people over there. I think I'll probably spend all day over there.
Wow.
So I'm looking forward to that. So it's going to be cool. So it should be interesting to see how that's received for us.
Wonderful.
And also, we do have something for children this year, and let's take advantage of that. So if your children are coming along, there are projects for them to do as well. We want to make sure that they are included.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
What
no
a great
charge,
idea.
Yeah.
And again, we want to remind everybody, this is a major fundraiser for the Racine Art Guild for the scholarships, which they give out. So, and we've already mentioned the raffle and the silent auction, which is a way in which people who visit this fair, which is otherwise free to the public, of course, can also be part of that fundraising effort.
Absolutely.
So we want to remind everybody once again that the Starving Artist Fair in Racine, Sunday in the park. I wore this tie on Sunday in the Park, just for to honor it, is Sunday, August 5th, 9 a.m. until 4 p.m. And
that's right.
The forecast is for a sunny, very warm day, a perfect day to be down by the lakefront. And this is on the Racine campus of Gateway Technical College, East Park, right there on Main Street between 10th and 11th. And it's an exciting event that many, many people look forward to year after year after year. Sue Smith is the chairwoman of the event this year. And Joe Nissen has been on hand for every one of these Starving Artist Fairs since the very first one 51 years ago. Mm-hmm. Great to have both of you here today. And I'll look forward to seeing you on Sunday at the art fair.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Looking forward to it.
Good
Thank
to you. Have you here. It's exactly 8:40. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD. Here's part two. And to finish out today's morning show, we're going to be hearing the conclusion of my follow-up conversation with Dr. Jerry Mast, Associate Professor of Political Science at Carthage College. He was my guest last week on The Morning Show, and we had a follow-up conversation then to talk about the upcoming midterm elections. In the excerpt played yesterday, we focused mostly on the Republicans and some of the challenges which they face in these upcoming midterm elections. And now it's time to talk about the Democrats. On the Democratic side, then, first of all, I think you would caution them to not just assume this is all going to swing their way.
Right.
I mean, there is no sense of this being absolutely inevitable. And on the other hand, there do seem to be certain very positive signs that this could be a good election for the Democrats. And you were just saying that historically it's often the case.
Right. And if we looked at very recent history, right, we can look at a number of elections that have occurred since the presidential election, right, in 2016. So we've had special elections to fill empty seats and so forth. And those have pretty consistently gone in a positive direction for the Democrats. The Democrats in those races have outperformed Hillary Clinton's vote share by a goodly amount. So, again, good reasons for the Democrats to feel confident that they've got a good shot at least capturing the House. The Senate will be a harder hill for them to climb simply because they have so many more races than the Republicans. Not all of the seats in the Senate are up for re-election every election, right? Mm. I mean, so there's every 2 years, a third of the seats are up. And right now, just so happens, it's a matter of coincidence, that there are more kind of vulnerable Democrats in terms of states that it's hard for Democrats to win in than there is for Republicans, right? So they have a harder hill to climb on the Senate.
In the Senate. I remember some years ago an interview with Todd Gitlin, a well-known activist from the 60s and early 70s, talking about how, in general, Republicans used to really more loyally and predictably adhere to kind of the party line, and the Democrats and probably just about anybody on the left, you know, tends
more
to be
over
just
the, all over
yeah, free-spirited yeah. and a little harder to handle, a little harder to corral, and so on. I don't know to what extent that kind of gross generalization remains true, but what do you see at the moment in terms of the Democratic Party and their capacity to coalesce around a coherent strategy
right.
for victory in these
right.
midterm elections?
Very similar challenges on their end relative to what the Republicans are kind of dealing with. Last week we talked about how our politics right now are in some sense a kind of a contest within the Republican Party over where the Republican Party is going to go, right? You have the president, who's popular amongst a lot of Republican voters. How popular, it's not clear, right? We talk about survey questions not quite getting at what they're really kind of saying. But you also have this kind of small but still at this point quite vocal cadre of critics of the president who are Republicans, right, the Never Trump Republicans, who are, I think, going to engage increasingly visibly over the each other over the direction of the Republican Party. I think that's also happening on the Democratic side, a kind of an anti-establishment kind of movement taking place, right? So a lot of attention was paid in the media to Joe Crowley, a member of the House of Representatives from New York. It was kind of like the guy being groomed to take Nancy Pelosi's place as Speaker someday. He got beat by an insurgent candidate, a rookie, to politics. She aligned herself with kind of democratic socialism. And that kind of a surprising outcome kind of reflects an energy level on the left, kind of the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. Now, in some ways, that outcome was exceptional. In many other kinds of Democratic primaries that we've seen, the more traditional establishment Democratic candidate, often incumbent, won. And so, you know, there's no real clear signal within the Democratic Party as far as electoral outcomes is concerned as to which wing is ascendant. Ms. Pelosi has said she intends to be to run for Speaker if the Democrats do take control. And in a normal year, there'd be kind of this general acclaim that, yes, but now there's grumbling, and that grumbling is public, right? And it really kind of unusual in that regard. And so if you listen to criticism of Charles Schumer, who is the minority leader in the Senate for the Democrats right now, could be coming from a Democrat as well as a Republican, that kind of criticism. And so I think the Democratic leadership is really beleaguered in a way, in part because of the outcome of the 2016 election, right? So Hillary Clinton was clearly the establishment choice to be the nominee, and then her failure to win the presidency was a real big black eye for the Democratic establishment.
Right, and so that the stink of that is still on
the
them.
The stink of a loss lingers.
Interesting. I wanted to read you something that comedian and talk show host Bill Maher said on the question of what would his advice be for liberals, particularly with these upcoming elections. Right. And his advice to liberals is, certainly vote and hope that Putin is not counting the votes this time. A block on Trump's legislative abilities by electing the Democratic Congress would be helpful. And the other thing liberals can do is don't make it so easy to hate them. The political correctness, BS. And then he cites this example of Matt Damon, an actor who said something to the effect of, I mean, can we please calm down that, you know, there's a difference between this and out and out, you know, sexual assault. And there was a huge chorus of protest and disagreement that about what he said. And in as far as Bill Maher is concerned, that, you know, that was a perfectly reasonable thing to say. And that when Democrats lash out at something like that, he says voters in the middle say to themselves, yeah, Trump is crazy, but you people are crazy, too. At least he's fun. In other words, so what Bill Maher is saying is that the Democrats are likely to lose some people from the middle if they adopt a certain voice, a certain sort of attitude that is alien to a certain sector of the population. I just thought that was kind of an interesting perspective, and be really curious to know if you think there's any merit to it at all.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's kind of an ongoing discussion about, well, should the party embrace a more progressive policy platform, right? The Bernie Sanders kind of argument, in the vein of a kind of a bold vision like Franklin Roosevelt's approach. Or should the Democratic Party, viewing its kind of historical circumstances, kind of double down on moderate kinds of centrist politics in order to kind of pull over, you know, more of those independents or disaffected Republicans,
as Bill Clinton did,
right? And I think it's important to remember that for the most part, voters don't care that much about policy specifics. The elections really aren't about particular policy platforms, and so this question about, you know, how the party should embrace kind of particular kinds of policy directions as a matter of politics, I mean, it's not irrelevant, but it's less important than people who like to engage in those kinds of conversations want to admit. What I think voters are really looking for, what I really think voters are looking for when it comes to, you know, whether or not a Democrat is going to play well is authenticity. Mm. Is this person a genuine kind of person? Does this person understand me, right? Us voters, do they understand our problems? Is this person qualified or competent in a general kind of sense? Those are the kinds of things that I think voters are likely to respond to, more so than, you know, purity with respect to a particular kind of policy platform.
Interesting. A last question, but this is kind of a big one and a complicated one. It has to do with Russian interference in the 2016 election and what interference is perhaps already at play in this 2018, you know, midterm election that hasn't even happened yet, of course. I think the first question is for you to help us understand the nature of what that interference was, as near as we know, or as far as has been revealed.
Still kind of being investigated.
A little bit murky, but the nature of what that interference is and the way that factor could play into these upcoming midterm elections, especially given the really interesting tweet of President Trump from a few days ago, and he basically said, you know, I've been really tough on Russia, so if they interfere in these elections, they're almost certainly going to want to want the Democrats to win. So, I mean, it really throws into question the ways in which this could be utilized. That is, just the specter of Russian interference can be used in some very intriguing ways.
As far as we deal with the specter in a bit, but as far as the actual involvement, I mean, I'm not an expert, and I think we're still trying to learn about this. Investigations are kind of ongoing. There's different categories of what it was that they've done. What we seem to know the most about is the degree of trolling that Russians engaged in. Russians were hired by firms kind of connected to the Kremlin to engage in social media participation that was designed to polarize us, right? To lend stability, to undercut faith in institutions, to undercut faith in the media, to undercut faith in each other, right? The larger goal of that form of Russian interference was to destabilize the American political culture, to destabilize the American political kind of the civic community, so to speak, to make us distrust each other, the system, and so forth. So that's that trolling operation is part of it. Now, we had said earlier, right, that we're engaged in this kind of larger polarization phenomena to begin with, right? So that's already kind of a pre-existing problem. What is the size of impact that the Russian involvement had in that regard? I have no idea. It's worth, you know, investigating and learning more about, but we don't know at this point. Another form of Russian involvement that we've kind of more recently learned about through some of the indictments that have been have come out of the special prosecutor's investigation, Robert Mueller's investigation, have included kind of funneling potentially money into the election through organizations like the National Rifle Association. So it's not clear how much money has gotten into the election, at least to my knowledge. I haven't seen very clear, concrete information as far as that's concerned. So, you know, how extensive that is, we don't know. I read recently about Russian groups taking control, buying certain kinds of internet domain names around local news organizations that aren't real local news organizations per se, but have the impression of being a local news source, so that they can use those. Or and they did this as far back, according to what I read, 2014, kind of waiting to set up these organizations to serve as some kind of plausible source of misinformation.
Right. Public Radio did a report on that. So for instance, you could buy up the domain name for Milwaukee News Watch. I mean, there's
no such thing.
But the fact that
it says Milwaukee News Watch makes you think, well, it must be a reputable source,
right?
And when it really isn't,
right? And this report was saying that at least generally speaking, people tend to place much more trust on local media than they do on national media, and so if, for instance, Russian trolls can masquerade as supposedly a local news organization, then whatever it is that
they can shape people's opinions more effectively.
Right. Yeah, they will be more quickly believed.
There's also been reporting on the indictments that have come out that have shown that the Russian computer hackers hacked into a number of state board election boards, acquired the names of Democrats. They've hacked into a business organization that sells software to verify voter registration lists and so forth. And so all of that kind of raises some troubling kinds of questions, but I don't think that we know at this point how far, if anywhere, those kinds of efforts went as far as actually impacting the election. And I guess that's where I kind of see the nature of Russian involvement in the election.
Right. So, in a sense, time will tell in terms of what their involvement is. I mean, one would hope that we are mindful of it at this point more so than we were 2 years ago.
Right, yeah. So, according to the intelligence agencies, they do predict that Russian efforts to influence the elections are ongoing. They expect this to happen this fall, attempts anyway. And of course, it becomes a political football. And here we kind of reach the kind of the specter of Russian involvement as opposed to the actual Russian involvement. Certainly the Democrats have tried to make this an issue by, you know, putting forward a proposal that would spend a lot of federal money to safeguard the elections to prevent Russian influence, and the Republicans have shot it down, saying we've spent quite a bit already, we don't need to spend more, and that allows for, you know, political finger pointing and so forth.
Right. So I'm sure your parting words of advice for anybody listening who cares about these upcoming elections is to not content themselves to post on Facebook what the latest thing that they're outraged about, but to get out and vote.
Well, absolutely. People need to vote. I think you should vary your media diet a little bit. You know, I think I'm preaching to the choir a little bit by saying public radio and PBS on the news hour on the evening news are pretty good sources of information. You know, the Chicago Tribune, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the Washington Post. Clearly are going to get some things wrong from time to time, and clearly there's going to be some, you know, degree of bias that creeps into some of the reporting that gets done. But for the most part, I think these are reputable organizations, and everybody should take what they read with a bit of salt. But if we become jaded and cynical about everything, then we have no basis on which to kind of relate to each other.
Well, on that guardedly hopeful note, I want to thank you again for joining me on The Morning Show, Dr. Jerry Mast, Associate Professor of Political Science at Carthage College. I really appreciate you being part of The Morning Show.
Good to be here, Greg.
It's 8:58 here on WGTD, and we have a really big week of morning shows coming up next week, and I'm excited to tell you about them. On Monday, Brian Albrecht, the president of Gateway Technical College, in his monthly visit to the program with two representatives of the American Heart Association and the dean of the nursing program here at Gateway, talking about heart-healthy practices. On Tuesday, Nan Calvert pays her monthly visit to the program, And her guest will be a gentleman from Sheboygan who has a plant-based business and also a new nonprofit that encourages the creation of edible landscapes in urban settings. Next week as well, we will be on Wednesday talking about an event that just finished up at Carthage, or finishes up today, actually, a two-week seminar on women's suffrage in the Americas. How did women get the vote in a place like Brazil or Argentina or Mexico? We'll be exploring that with a variety of scholars. And on Thursday and Friday, talking politics. On Thursday, with